are listening to Cover Stories, a deep dive into the stories behind iconic album art with Adam Charlie O. Patricia Lee Smith moved from New Jersey to New York City in 1967. On her first day in New York, she found her way to Brentano's bookstore on Fifth Avenue, where she met a young man with dark curls who looked like a hippie shepherd boy. His name was Robert, and he bought a necklace that Smith really liked. "Don't give it to any girl but me," she told him. This was day one in a 22-year friendship. Smith describes her meeting with artist Robert Mapplethorpe like this: "I was a bad girl trying to be good, and he was a good boy trying to be bad." They ended up living together for a time at the cheapest room in the Chelsea Hotel, ground zero of New York's alternative artistic scene. They were lovers until Mapplethorpe realized he was gay. Their friendship endured as artistic partners and friends for many years. By 1975, Patti Smith and her band were well established as a popular act in New York City's underground rock music scene. Clive Davis, who had recently launched Arista Records, was scouting for talent and signed Smith to a 7-album recording deal in April 1975. Smith had a vision for her debut album. In her words, it was to make a record that would make a certain type of person not feel alone. People who were like me, different. I wasn't targeting the whole world. I wasn't trying to make a hit record. The title of her album was Horses. Smith had a desire to see the rejuvenation of rock music, which she thought had reacted to the social turmoil of the 1960s and the deaths of numerous prominent rock musicians, by growing calm. She said, "Psychologically, somewhere in our hearts, we were all screwed up because those people died. We all had to pull ourselves together. To me, that's why our record's called Horses. We had to pull the reins on ourselves to recharge ourselves. We've gotten ourselves back together. It's time to let the horses loose again. We're ready to start moving again." So, Horses it would be. The record, her first album, was as much poetry and social commentary as it was rock. Mapplethorpe, of course, was well on his way to becoming an accomplished photographer and controversial artist when Smith needed a cover for her debut album. Smith said she always knew Mapplethorpe would shoot the album cover for Horses. Based on their long-standing friendship, it must have been something they both always knew. Mapplethorpe did take the photograph for the album cover. Smith seems to have had a pretty clear idea what she wanted to do for the cover, but said she had no sense of how it would look, just that it should be true. When she discussed it, she said, "The only rule we had was Robert told me if I wore a white shirt not to wear a dirty one." On a trip to the Salvation Army on the Bowery, Smith found a pile of white button-downs. She chose one that had an RV embroidered on the breast pocket. She said it reminded her of the movie Barbarella. The photo was shot in the Greenwich Village apartment of Mapplethorpe's partner, Sam Wagstaff, sometime in 1975. Smith selected her favorite ribbon and draped it around her collar, almost like a pair of suspenders, and she tried several poses before throwing her black jacket over her shoulder, Frank Sinatra style, leading to the portrait that's so well known and loved today. A horse pin given to her by Blue Oyster Cult guitarist Alan Lanier is attached to her jacket. Smith described her appearance as recalling those of French poet Charles Baudelaire and singer Frank Sinatra. She recalled that Mapplethorpe took like 12 pictures, and at about the 8th one, he said, "I have it." I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "I just know." And I said, "Okay," and that was it. In the final shot, Smith is shrouded in natural light. It's a simple portrait of a woman from the waist up in a crisp white shirt, a black ribbon draped over her shoulders, in dark jeans, and Joey Ramone haircut. Her jaw juts out proudly, defiantly even. The wall she's leaning against is as brilliant white as her shirt, It's a blank and blinding canvas. The black and white photograph and her androgynous pose were a significant departure from the typical promotional images of female singers of the time. One critic said, "At first glance, she could be your limo driver, high school best friend, or first date. In this way, Smith, one of New York's then most talked about songwriters, poets, and performers, was all of us. We were all her." The album draws the viewer in by playing with both Smith's sense of identity and her sexuality. She emits a kind of third gender aura that is bold in its femininity. All of this was unintentionally intentional and expertly done by Mapplethorpe. Some record label executives wanted to make changes to the photograph. Smith overruled their suggestions. Clive Davis later said he was initially conflicted about the image. He recognized its power, but felt it would confuse audiences unfamiliar with Smith and her style of music. In the end, he put aside his reservations and approved the cover after realizing he needed to trust Smith's artistic instincts thoroughly. The photo shoot that became the cover for Horses was a defining moment for Smith. Today, the print is regarded as a classic portrait, and it's part of the Tate Collection in the United Kingdom. At the time Mapplethorpe took this photograph, he and Smith had known each other for the better part of a decade. Smith's album would make her one of the biggest stars of the New York punk scene, alongside the Ramones, Blondie, and Talking Heads. Camilla Paglia, a feminist writer of the time, called the Horses cover one of the greatest pictures ever taken of a woman. World Cafe radio host Talia Schlanger said, "Smith's unapologetic androgyny predates a time when that was an in vogue or even available option for women. And it represents a seminal moment in the reversal of the female gaze. Smith is looking at you and could care less what you think about looking at her." That was radical for a woman in 1975. It's still radical today. Looking back, Smith said she had not intended to make a big statement with the cover. She said it simply reflected the way she dressed, and it portrayed herself accurately. "I wasn't thinking that I was going to break any boundaries. I just liked dressing like Baudelaire." Turn the album cover over and you find photos of the four members of her band and a solid block of Smith's poetry that includes the lines, "As for me, I am truly ready to go." Speaking to her horses, she later adds, "Charmed sweet angels, you have made me no longer afraid of death." I like opening lines for albums, and Horses has a good one. It's from Smith's poem Oath. She says, "Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine." It was a declaration of what she dubbed positive anarchy. Horses was released November 10, 1975, and it was met with near universal acclaim from music critics. It is easily her most iconic album. Its fusion of poetry and rock and roll make it an early punk masterpiece. Let's hit the pause button and chat a bit.
Because the night belongs to lovers, the day must belong to us here at Album Art Cover Stories. Now, while not from today's album, that little reference should tip you off to the artist. And if it didn't, don't worry, you're in good company. This is actually one of my blind spots that we're digging into today.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah. I've had so many. I'm glad to know that some exist for...
We share this somewhere. One, yeah. All yeah. Right, so we're discussing the landmark 1975 album from Patti Smith. Then, despite my long-held interest in punk, the bands that predated it, or predicted it, so to speak, are sometimes, you know, like I said, blind spots for me. Velvet Underground, Television, Talking Heads, but chief among them would be Patti Smith, who I don't consider a punk artist, and I don't think she would balk much at that.
No, I don't think so.
I was curious because we're fresh off of doing podcasts on both the Sex Pistols and The Clash, so I'm guessing you wouldn't have necessarily made the connection on your own here.
Oh, absolutely not. I was oblivious to the progression in music. Really, I was.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm a little embarrassed to say so. I think back, I was thinking recently, I thought, well, it started off as rock and roll, and then we got some heavy metal, and then we had psychedelic music, and then we had disco. But you know, that's such a narrow view of the progression that music was going through at the time.
Yeah, there were these subtle shifts and changes.
Yeah,
for sure. So you know, absolutely a bridge artist, and I would call her proto-punk. You know, and I kind of disavow the tag in much the same way I don't like when Neil Young is dubbed the godfather of grunge. But you know what I'm getting at here. I think she predates punk in just enough time, but she really helped lay the groundwork. One thing, though, I would say about Patti Smith that I always have always thought of her as more of a writer. And that's not to say she's not
a poet.
Incredible writer.
Yeah, incredible writer.
Yeah. I know I've mentioned this to you before, but her memoir of her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe called Just Kids won the National Book Award in 2010, and it is staggeringly good. That's coming from someone who wasn't even much of a fan before. But yeah, so dig that out if you can, people. So, you know, to me, Smith always felt simultaneously young and vital and also old and wise. And part of that, I think, is, you know, her connecting, you know, she connected herself back to the past, you know, certainly Baudelaire and people like that. But when she first came to New York, did she meet Mapplethorpe on her first day? Is that right?
Well, that's the way it sounded. It sounded like she was out looking for a job and, you know, she got to New York. Here I am. I need a job. I'm going to go out and take a look. And she, the bad girl trying to be good, met the good guy trying to be bad in the store. And the lifelong friendship followed.
Yeah, I liked how she put that.
Yeah, it sounded like it was the first day.
Yeah, artistic kismet, to be sure. Now, you know, it's
some neighborhoods, huh?
Yeah.
You think of Laurel Canyon out west, and then, you know, we got the village here in New York.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just amazing the synergy.
Yeah,
the relationships that came from these I don't know what do you call it, a clan, a
hyper localized communities, and I would say, you know, this especially in New York, it was kind of like the sleazy analog to Laurel Canyon, because let's talk about the Chelsea Hotel for just a moment where they briefly ended up. It sounds wild. It's the subject of Warhol's Chelsea Girls. It's where Bob Dylan famously lived during the Blonde on Blonde era. And most famously and sadly, the site where Sid Vicious killed his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen. Mm. Quite a place.
I didn't know that history.
Yeah. It was quite the place.
Yeah.
It was quite the place. So sort of a flop house for the celebs. So by the time 1975 rolls around, Patti Smith is already pretty well established as a poet, a painter, certainly a musician in the New York City underground. But imagine being approached in 2024 by Clive Davis or anyone else and offered a 7-album record deal?
Who gets a 7-album record deal?
Just wild.
The blue. Yeah.
And, you know,
somebody who's trying to start a record company.
It's just wild to me. You know, the talent was obviously there, but Patti Smith to me really seems like a risky proposition. You know, she had the songs, but it was not a traditional approach to music and certainly not to rock and roll. Or the punk that had yet to really be defined. So I think it's interesting, but let's talk the namesake of this album. I've long heard of the classic handling of this album, but never dove into what that really meant. And
I thought horses, you mean?
Yeah, the horses. Just, you know, it's called Horses, and I have no idea what that means at first glance. But really digging into it, it was cool. It was as if she was calling upon the 70s, or calling upon her generation to be the horsepower
that
called back the mojo that rose and fell with the deaths of a lot of artists in the 60s, you know, whom she seemed to really hold in high regard.
Yeah, the 27 Club.
Yeah, the majority of whom we've already profiled here on the show. Now, Mapplethorpe wasn't yet the name that he came to be, right?
No, I don't think anybody knew much about Mapplethorpe in 75.
Okay. But in local circles, you would imagine his photography was still in demand and, again, also highly regarded.
And he had the advantage of being controversial. This was at a time when the country was changing from, you know, the Victorian age to whatever was coming after that. And so, he was able to hit a couple of hot buttons there that certainly helps your rise to.
Oh, it certainly does. Very, very Warholian, as it were. Now, you know, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe already having this pre-existing relationship, it probably would have felt like a betrayal if Smith didn't let Mapplethorpe shoot the cover of her album, but she wanted that anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So that was going to happen regardless.
Meant to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, in reading your research, it's really funny to me to compare the idea for this album cover shoot to virtually any other album that we've discussed. It's simplicity. You know, I think Smith just wanted a really true portrayal of who she was at the time, done as, or, you know, as done by someone that can understand who she is and truly show who she is with Mapplethorpe. But what was his one requirement?
A clean white shirt.
And she kind of did that, but, you know, it felt in character that she went to the Salvation Army.
It was a used clean white shirt.
Very used. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, all to say, this wasn't Thriller. You know, there's no tigers, there's no fancy jackets. A little less demanding than Prince or the Stones, you know. What I love about this, and what I've always loved about this photo or this cover, is that it walks the line between artsy and pretentious without falling over into one or the other, even necessarily. You know, I think some of the outtakes from this session are pretty cool. Did you come across any of those in your research?
I really wish we had a way to share those things with listeners.
Yeah.
Some of the really cool images that you run across.
Well, these are seriously well-informed music fans that listen to our podcast, so I'm sure they're already already online, on Googling all of them. That's right. But the true stroke of genius, as we can clearly see, is that Sinatra-esque jacket over the shoulder that she did just in a moment. You know, I think that really made the entire piece.
Yeah, that was very cool. She was definitely bleeding on the cutting edge of third genders.
Yeah,
And I loved one description that I read that she looked like a limo driver. And I thought, that's exactly it. That's, you know, that was the job that she found. She was driving a limo. She was off for the day. She was heading out to some club, listening to some music. As simple as it was, it really set my imagination a bit on fire for, you know, all that was packed into it.
Yeah, and I like that, you know, sort of, you know, the limo driver to the other stars, but turns out the limo driver is just as much an artist as you are. You know, I think it was neat to see, but it was a really, you know, a compliment to the surroundings, which I would lovingly call drab or minimalist or a little more respectfully, Spartan. You know, it was very artistic, but there's an air of mystery that I think you did capture well in your research. A simple jacket that a man would have been more likely to wear at the time is really a big deal. You know, you call it a third gender, which I think is really cool. You know, to call it androgynous would be an understatement. So I think that's apt. But that's no small risk at the time.
Yeah, especially at the time. I mean, that was huge.
Oh, it was massive.
That was risking your career.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was putting it all on the line.
Well, unless you have a 7-album deal, you know. Yeah. You only get 6 more chances of this. You scrap that first one. But, you know, all this to say, Robert Mapplethorpe was just too good. Just too good. In that Ansel Adams way, I think if any of us attempted to take such an incredible shot with such a limited amount of accoutrements, you know, it just wouldn't work.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't work.
Being so simple is really a complex
undertaking. Incredibly difficult, you know. And I think that simple decision to make it black and white is also perfect.
Yeah.
I think oftentimes people make the mistake of making something black and white when they want to try and add a little to something that's missing. You know, whatever mystique that this particular photo has, but it also so instantly timeless, evocative, and emblematic of Patti Smith. To this day, this is still the photo that pops up maybe in the first 10 Google image searches. This is the one that represents Patti Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Not just for that period, but for her entire career. Yeah. And she certainly wasn't, you know, she wasn't far from a camera at most times, certainly during the 70s and the early 80s. But one thing that I really like is, you know, she name checks literature so much. She name checks so much literature in her music, and she even approaches, well, you know, I think she approaches punk rock like a poet. You know, that's what really sets it apart for me, you know, in just the tone and the vibe and even the sound. You know, she talks about Baudelaire, who, while she looks nothing like the poet, the genius that wrote Flowers of Evil in that photo shoot, she was channeling something other than the controversial musicians at the time. She was an artist through and through. I think she lived it and breathed it, you know, but, go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking that you're speaking. I'm thinking, she fit right into that community up there, art community.
She truly did. I think it's just a tremendous photograph, an early document of proto-punk. You know, one of the first signs that there was something bubbling under that was begging to be liberated. And we were still a few years away from the explosion, but she was one of the people that had
a start.
She had the match. Yes, you know, indeed. She had one of those matches. Yes, but I'm glad to have been able to dive into something that I didn't have a lot of experience with.
Yeah, and it made me listen to the album.
It did. Agreed. Well, Patty, thanks for joining us. Clive Davis, thanks for signing, Patty. We'll see you next time.